From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is wearing a name tag today, so I'll read from it. He's our resident analyst. He's a contributing writer with City Paper and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. I wouldn't have known that unless you were wearing that tag. Where did it come from?
I spent all morning, 2 hours, with a bunch of public information officers from the FL-CIO downtown at 16th and the I Street.
And they had to give you a name tag? Don't they know who you are? You've been on television for 100 years.
Unlike many in the media, Kojo, I'm polite and not arrogant. I don't assume people know my name. I'm so glad you know it.
You wore the name tag, which is very good. Later in the broadcast, we'll be talking to two members of the Virginia General Assembly, one a veteran delegate, Vivian Watts, the other a freshman delegate, Kathy Tran. Joining us in studio now is Matt Letourneau. He is a Dulles District Supervisor for Loudoun County. He's also chairman of the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments Board of Directors. Matt Letourneau, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you have questions or comments for Matt Letourneau, give us a call, 800-433-8850. What the heck does he do for a living, you want to know? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org, and join the conversation there. Tom, before we begin our focus on Matt, let's focus on Prince George's County for a second, where a report reveals that school superintendent Kevin Maxwell has made at least two significant political contributions. The one, I guess, that may be more significant is a $500 contribution to the vice chair of the school board, Carolyn Boston. That contribution was apparently made on December 21st, even though the board committee evaluating him, of which she is a member, would be holding one of its meetings the next day. Then, of course, there's the $2,000 contribution to the gubernatorial campaign of Rashawn Baker, the county executive, who is the person who employs or hired Mr. Maxwell.
Well, you know, I don't mind that somebody wants to give money to a gubernatorial campaign, but I don't know why they call him the CEO of the school system. Kevin Maxwell decided it was a good idea to give $500 or a dollar to the vice chair of the school board that was doing its assessment of his work. You know, he works for the school board, although he's appointed in a convoluted way by a nominating committee that's appointed by the governor and then gets three recommendations. It's a mess, but I just don't understand. Mr. Maxwell has not explained why he thought it was important to give money to the school board member. And I just think we need to hear from him to know more about it. But with the school system already having issues about graduation rates and grading systems and all of that, just like the district, it just seems to me you would want to avoid any political entanglement. And if you're going to give $500, why not just give lots of people lots of money if you're going to do it? It just looks bad. And this, we have to point out, we were told that the money, I think the Post did this story first, Washington Post, that the money was returned after it was checked for ethics. In this case,
why'd they have to check for ethics?
I was going to say, if you have to check for ethics, you need to have an ethics refresher course.
Exactly right. If that individual gives you some money and you're responsible for his evaluation and you're having a meeting the next day, something should
tell you. Well, I want to know how many other contributions has he made to local people who have directly affected his job, because it undermines, you know, he's gotten some pretty good support on that school board. There's a faction of the board that really dislikes him and didn't want him reappointed. But apart from all that, why throw political money into the mix?
Well, as we said, our guest is Matt Letourneau. He's a Dulles District Supervisor for Loudoun County. Do you get contributions from people you supervise?
I can safely say I don't believe that's ever occurred.
Okay, just checking. Matt, President Trump released his major infrastructure initiative this week, and the impact on the region could be big. You were elected chairman of the Metropolitan Washington Council of Governments in January, so let me start by asking you. One proposal is selling and privatizing airports, including Dulles, which is in your district, and National Airport in Arlington. It's just, at this point, a proposal, but what might a privatized airport mean for the district that you represent and for the region longer term?
Well, it's honestly very difficult to say because this was pretty much a few sentences in a outline with no detail, and it really caught everybody by surprise. I will say that Dulles and National are very unique. A lot of people don't realize they're the only two federally owned airports in the country. And I've never thought that that was a particularly good thing because I think that we're more than capable of running our own airports here. There is the Metropolitan Washington Airports Authority, which is congressionally authorized. It has representatives from Maryland, D.C., Virginia, and the administration. And they do the day-to-day. So it's not like Dulles and National actually get any real federal money other than the money that's available to all other airports. But we have a great partnership with Dulles. It's important to the region. We obviously want to protect it, but we just need to know more about exactly what they're thinking, whether it's a true privatization like the type that we've seen in Europe. This is actually fairly common, and some of those airports are very nice, actually. People say nicer than ours. Or if it's something like just transferring it to the state and local governments for control. So we'll have to wait and see.
Which would be a huge expense to do that. But this, a lot of people think the president's proposed budget is a fantasy land budget anyway. The Congress, the Republican Congress, will see what it wants to do. I suspect that the members of Congress do not want to give up any control over National Airport. And their first thing I'd do if I
Why
ran
would you
it,
suspect
I would,
that? Because
I would
they
take
use
their parking
that airport.
Space. No, I think this is just one of a number of things within the Trump budget that is just not, excuse me, not going to ever see the light of day. But it would affect the changes. I mean, Loudoun County is a remarkable county. It's growing. It's one of the fastest growing counties?
Yeah, I think it's safe to say one of now. But we're up to almost 400,000 people.
But how much of the federal interest? You know, there are a lot of federal workers in the Washington metropolitan area. What is your workforce out there in terms of private and public employees?
Yeah, contracting is probably a bigger deal than direct federal, but about 10-12% of our employees actually commute to the district every day. About 50% work in the county, and one of our goals is to continue to diversify. Of course, we're a big tech capital. 70% of the world's internet traffic goes through Loudoun County. So
there's those data centers.
Data centers, yeah. But a lot more than that as well. We've really been expanding. But still, obviously, the federal government has an important role for our workforce and for the whole region.
This is the most important question, this being the politics hour. Are you for or against a Washington Redskins stadium in Loudoun County?
I am noncommittal. I'll put it this way.
You don't want to pay for a stadium.
No.
No one wants to pay for
no
that
No one
stadium.
Wants to pay for it. And I think, really, the opportunities are minimal for greenfield development for a project as large as a stadium that's accessible to Metro. There aren't too many places left in the region where that could happen. So Loudoun's name gets mentioned every time this comes up because we are one of those places. But I'll say, even in Loudoun, we have big plans around those Metro stations. Maybe we'll talk about some of those other things that might be out there, including a certain tech company. But there is a lot of opportunities for development there. And
you mentioned Amazon. Without saying the name, would you
he
write
didn't
a
mention
like
Amazon.
The
he
blank
said a certain
check,
tech
you know,
company? You could
the
be talking
blank
about
check,
Microsoft.
You know, that the Secretary of Transportation over in Maryland said we'd give them a blank check. I think Larry Hogan nearly
and
had
he
a
walked
heart
that
attack.
Statement yeah. back and said it's a non-blank check, blank check.
Yeah, it's like blankety blank blank is what he said.
Well,
but what do you think about how much are you willing to roll over for Amazon?
Well, I'll put it this way: the money incentives that we're talking about in this type of deal are not going to come from local governments in any significant way. The order of magnitude for what the states are putting on the table is far greater. But I think it is remarkable that the D.C. region has three sites in the running in the top 20 for Amazon. Obviously, being from Loudoun County, I'm particularly fond of the site that we've
But as head of COG, you represent all
Absolutely.
Three sites, so to
yes.
speak. Are you involved in the region's bid at all for Amazon?
Well, there isn't so much a regional bid as much as the individual
jurisdiction.
And the Council of Governments did do quite a bit of initial work to put together some of the facts and figures that all the states and D.C. are using. Because of the way incentives work, it was very difficult to do a true regional bid. That said, we all acknowledge, and we've said this on the COG board, that any one of us who receives Amazon, it's going to be a win for the whole region. Because we're a very large metropolitan area. We're in the top 10. We can absorb it. We're already planning for 1.1 million more jobs and 1.5 million more people by 2045. Mm-hmm. So 50,000 sounds like a lot, but it's phased in over time. It would be a fantastic thing for the whole region. For us, going back to the point I just made, Amazon is calling for greenfield development. There's not too many places left where we can do that. And we've already planned for 3 million square feet of office adjacent to our metro there, as well as 5,000 residential units. Already been through a zoning process on that. So all we're waiting for is a tenant. So whether it's Amazon or anyone else, I think the region is ready for that type of development.
But this Amazon deal brings up an interesting broader question, and that is the region's need to balance competition and cooperation. As chairman at COG, what's the right balance? Is there a point at which you say, wait a minute, you guys are offering just too much, all of you, to Amazon. Let's rein this in a little bit, or just let the specific jurisdictions do as they will?
I think it's both. I don't think it's our place to say that somebody, some particular jurisdiction, is offering too much money, because for one thing, at the local level, the state's not going to listen to us anyway. They usually don't. But I do think that there is an acknowledgement and there is a need to make sure that when we compete, we're doing so in a way that's good for the region. In other words, we can be promoting our own bids and are promoting our own jurisdictions without disparaging anybody else's. And to that end, COG is focused on a number of things. One of them is actually exports. We do very, very poorly exporting our professional services and the goods that we do manufacture here. And we do have some advanced manufacturing in this region. We ranked near the bottom nationwide in that. So the Council of Governments put together an effort to try to improve that, to get everybody together involved in one joint effort, because it's good for everybody to be able to export things that come from our jurisdiction. So those are the sorts of things that we look for, those places where everybody actually has a piece. But, you know, you look at a bid like Amazon, you're looking at transportation, which affects everybody in the region. You're looking at education. That's a big deal. All the higher education universities here would be part of that. So it's not going to be any one jurisdiction that's going to be just doing
it. In case you're just joining us, our guest is Matt Latorno. He's Dulles District Supervisor for Loudoun County. He's also chairman of the Metropolitan Washington Council of Government Board of Directors.
Politically speaking, in the broad sense, not campaign sense, but just politically, how influential is the Council of Governments? I often have kind of gotten weary of seeing all the reports it does. It issues lots of reports. It has that UN-style table downtown on North Capitol Street, where you have to, you know, give blood to get into the building.
I've moderated discussions around that.
I complain so much they actually gave me a pass. But
what we can do for you.
So what is the influence of COG? Can you cite some successes? I know you're chairman for just this 1 year.
For this year. I was vice chairman last year, so I've been involved.
What are the successes? Because, you know, transportation is it's the issue in the entire region. What's COG doing? Why are you here?
let's start with Metro, because that's obviously the biggest thing for the region right now. COG is very unique, particularly in that space, because we're the only entity of its kind that actually has D.C., Maryland, and Virginia in the table. Now, I'm also vice chairman of a group called the Northern Virginia Transportation Commission, which deals with public transit in Virginia, and I also sit around a table there, but that's just Virginia. So, you know, for instance, when the Metro Safety Commission was sort of forced upon us by the Federal Transit Administration, COG was the entity that actually put it together and that sat and organized and then negotiated between the jurisdictions what the specifics would be. And then that had to go to the Virginia General Assembly, Maryland, and D.C., and so forth, and then eventually to Congress. So I think our role is actually more important now than it's really ever been, because Metro is at the forefront of our discussions. Right now, there's an effort to get more money for Metro.
Dedicated funding
sources for capital. We have a need of $450 million a year.
Is that looking better, the prospects for that? Where do things stand in the Virginia legislature, and what would it mean for Northern Virginia and Metro more generally?
It's good in that for the first time this is actually on the table. The devil is in the details. Unfortunately, one of the funding sources that Virginia is looking at in the House bill is to actually raid the regional Northern Virginia Transportation Authority, which is mostly road money that has been dedicated to
the proposal Governor McAuliffe put forward in his final budget would have levied taxes mainly on Northern Virginia to pay for this dedicated funding source. But a lot of people see that as fair.
We would like to see a greater investment from the state and from the federal government. So both proposals, the House and Senate and the governors, current and former, put about $30 million of new state money in, which is really kind of insufficient when you consider what the impact is of Metro on the entire state.
Doesn't want to say peanuts, but go ahead.
But I'm also a realist. I understand what the dynamic is. And so there's two proposals on the table right now. The Governor McAuliffe's did the same thing that the House bill does, which is that it diverts money from a regional transportation pot, which ironically, some of that money is actually already going to Metro, that we're all depending on, and then puts it into this. The Senate bill raises some new revenue only in Northern Virginia through the transit occupancy tax, through the grantor's tax, those sorts of things. And that's a lot more palatable for us because it doesn't actually take money away from projects that we desperately need. But the good news is everybody's talking. There actually are some proposals on the table. The District of Columbia has a proposal that's a lot different than what Maryland and Virginia are talking about. They want to impose a 0.75 tax on the entire region. Virginia and Maryland don't much like that. I think especially in the case of Virginia, because our jurisdictions are so large, you would end up imposing that tax on the entire jurisdiction. And we view that as very unfair, and that's not going to go anywhere in Maryland, Virginia. But I think that's sort of understood. So at this point, after these sessions, we'll once again go back to COG. We'll take the pieces of this and we'll put them all together. And another important factor and the real progress that's been made is on the idea of governance reform and on greater flexibility for the Metro General Manager. I've been involved in this discussion now for a number of years. The evolution over the last 2 years on this topic is amazing. 2 years ago, the sorts of things that are on the table now would have been laughed off, and there was a lot of objections to them. But there's now an understanding that in order to get more money from Metro, from the state, and even from the localities, there have to be changes. We're looking at reform boards, smaller boards. We're looking at a greater flexibility to go to outside contractors for certain services. All those things are now on the table as part of these reform packages. And there's a lot of agreement at COG and within the region that they should be on the table.
Paul Wiedefeld, the general manager, has said that if this dedicated funding issue is not solved by this summer, even he said this last year, this coming summer, that he has to start planning on, it's like a government shutdown. If I don't have this X money, I'm going to have to do Y in order to cut back on capital expenditures. And we already see massive shutdown of the system on a regular basis now for SafeTrack and this new approach. He says we are not going to be able to do what we need to do. And people keep saying, well, we have to improve our government procedures in order to get money. He says we can't improve the government procedures unless we get the money. So it seems like a real mess. But you are right. Both Maryland and Virginia, after dragging their feet for years, are now at least talking about doing something, even though it may be insufficient.
Yeah, and let's be very clear on one thing, and I say this as a Republican.
I was going to ask you if you're a Republican.
I am. My friends in the General Assembly who don't want to raise taxes in order to pay for Metro, if a funding source is not come up with that fully funds $150 million a year, Virginia's commitment, then all they will be doing is passing that burden onto the local governments. Because Maryland, the state of Maryland, funds Metro, D.C. funds Metro, but in Virginia, most of it actually comes from localities. So what we will all have to do, and these are big, big numbers given the capital needs, is go into our property taxes and have to raise property taxes on all of our residents in order to do this. So you are not avoiding tax increases no matter what you do here. It makes more sense to do this in a way that's fairer to everybody.
Transportation, clearly. Did you drive in today from Loudoun County?
I actually work in D.C., so I did.
Oh,
drive in, yes.
Okay, good. But it's usually about a 30, I think the average is a 30, 35-minute commute for people who live in Loudoun County.
Oh, a lot more than that.
Well, I mean, that's official, the average. But
You mean
What type of work do you do, may I ask?
I work for a trade association here in town.
Oh, a rare trade association in Washington.
None of
you get time to do that with all of the other committees that you sit on.
You want to say which
here?
One it is? Give them a free plug?
No, that's okay. I keep my life separate.
Well, compare and contrast, if you will, because you said if Amazon comes to these, whatever jurisdiction it comes to, whether in Montgomery County, in the district, or in Virginia, it'll be a win-win for the region. But another piece of news that will potentially have a big impact on the region, the FBI headquarters will remain in the district. Northern Virginia was in the running for a new consolidated headquarters for those 11,000 employees. It's been hinted at since last July when the GSA scrapped the long-running search. But what does it mean, A, for the region? B, what does it mean for Northern Virginia? Because some 2,000 of the FBI jobs is now going to be dispersed to other places in the country.
Right.
Is this a win-win for the region?
Well, we'll have to see what the final disposition of that is. Obviously, we've seen the proposals, and that's a concern for a lot of my colleagues on the Council of Governments Board and in the, my fellow jurisdictions. I'll say this. It's been very clear to us for some time that we have to diversify, that we cannot be as reliant on the federal government. The federal government is going in a different direction. The region is growing. There were some grave predictions during sequestration that this region would really suffer economically because the federal government was contracting. And it did for a short period of time. But we bounced back very quickly because there are some smart people here that are able to sort of feed on some of the government work that, that's done and then move into the private sector. And because of technology, because of biomedical, particularly in Maryland, all over, we're able to diversify. And this is just another example why we can't be as reliant on the federal government to provide the jobs that we need.
It's going to be stable. It just won't grow maybe as much as it has. I remember back to Ronald Reagan, they were going to cut the federal government. And, of course, it's grown ever since. But, you know, the FBI, I'm not so certain that the decision that it's going to stay there and redo the building, that building is inadequate for what the FBI needs, both for security purposes and for just egress and ingress for this building. And it's a, and the city really doesn't want the FBI right there on Pennsylvania Avenue because it will create a dead zone. By the time they do all their security barriers and some of the hocus pocus that they go through for bureaucratic reasons, that will be a dead zone right on Pennsylvania Avenue. I think the city would love for them to leave so that the city can redevelop that space. I think it's like 11 acres. Or it's a huge space, yeah. But I'm not sure the FBI can even fit there. Even if
well, that's a question from Richard that you probably can't answer, but I just like
I love those questions.
I just like the idea of asking it. Okay. Richard says, if we privatize the local airports, how about corporate naming rights? It's always been ironic that the president who fired the air controllers would have an airport named after him. How about we replace the name with Amazon International Airport? See, if you privatize, these are the kinds of considerations that will have to be considered.
Well, yeah, the Redskins are looking for a naming right for their stadium. But.
Well, local election officials are looking at ways to prevent hacking or other disruptions, yep. including by Russian hackers. Loudoun County is among those doing so, along with other Northern Virginia jurisdictions. How vulnerable are the databases and the voting machines?
Well, we had a report at the Council of Governments this week on that topic, and that's another one of those things that we're able to do is get people together, share some best practices. The good news was there's no direct evidence that we are vulnerable. There's no direct evidence that we were hacked, but many jurisdictions, including Virginia, have moved away from touchscreen voting for some concerns. The evolution has been focused towards cybersecurity, towards protecting data. That continues. But it's an issue. It's not a unique issue for this region. It's an issue for the entire country, of course. But the good news is there's been a lot of effort already in place to deal with it and make sure that we do have integrity of those systems.
This 2018 is a big election year nationwide.
We only have about 2 minutes left.
Except in Virginia, where they have everything an off year. What are the?
We have federal elections this year, too. Well, Senate and Congress.
The Congress, right. Are there any local elections in Loudoun County?
Not in Loudoun, no. We're on the 19 cycle. So.
Okay.
Yeah, but there are some around the region.
Well, we're going to be talking to Vivian Watts, is that right?
Very shortly.
She knows a great deal about transportation. She was a transportation secretary under Jerry Blyles, I think it was, when they actually got a lot of things done on transportation. What for the people who live in your area, what is the biggest transportation issue? Do you need more freeways or what do you need?
Yeah, it's still roads, road infrastructure. When you grow as fast as we grow, it's very difficult for the infrastructure to keep up. And if we do want to continue to see at least employment growth, we're going to need to continue to improve infrastructure. So our jurisdiction decided that the state was not doing nearly enough, and we started dedicating a portion of our budget for local funding. And it's now the largest part of our capital budget. It's going to be over $1 billion in transportation funding that the county is actually paying for. Road network, north-south corridor from 6695 all the way up to Route 7, so North Star Boulevard. We just completed an extension of Loudoun County Parkway. Those type of projects. I represent the Route 50 corridor, which is terrible congestion, so we're looking at some alternatives to that. And also around our metro stations. We have a road called the Dulles Greenway, everybody's been focused on 66 tolls, which are still a big issue for us, but the Dulles Greenway is privately owned. It's a great model of of how not to do one of those projects. It was established in 1993, and we've been paying $5, $6 tolls with no distance pricing all that time. And so what the county has had to do is actually build a road network around the Dulles Greenway, even though it's a wonderful, underutilized six-lane road, because nobody will pay those tolls. And the State Corporation Commission conducts very limited oversight. We were involved in litigation trying to prove that they weren't meeting their obligations. We went all the way to the State Supreme Court. We lost. It's going to take executive leadership at this point in Virginia to deal with that. But that is those are the sorts of things that we're dealing with.
Matt Latorna, he is the Dulles District Supervisor for Loudoun County. He's also the chairman of the Metropolitan Council of Governments Board of Directors. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be talking shortly with two delegates in the Virginia General Assembly, Delegate Vivian Watts and Delegate Kathy Tran. If you have questions or comments for them, start calling now, 800-433-8850. Send us a tweet at Kojo Show, email to kojo@wamu.org, or you can go to our website, kojoshow.org. Also watch the live video stream of this broadcast, or ask a question or make a comment there. Tom Sherwood, how important is it or not that the head of the District of Columbia Board of Elections, the director, Alice P. Miller, lives in Upper Silver Spring and not in the District of Columbia? There was a waiver that was granted by the Board of Elections to allow her to live there, presumably because she has more expertise than anybody who lives in the district.
Yes, this story was in the Washington City paper. Andrew Jambroni reported it.
Tracks housing everywhere.
Yes, he does everything. Alice P. Miller is the person we're talking about, and she had worked for decades around the city's issues. It came as a surprise to me that Alice Miller
Same
lives
here.
In the suburbs. Ken McGee, the general counsel for the board, told Andrew that, yes, she does, that she was given a waiver because the board looked over and did a nationwide search for a director, and they didn't find a good one, and Alice knew everything, and that she would be good, so they were going to give her that waiver. I dare say that if you do a search in the nation, you will not find a director of a elections board who does not live in the jurisdiction which he or she does her or his job. And so this is why it's unusual. This is as much as I know a lot about Alice Miller and the work she's doing, I would say if you do not respect your own borders, why do you expect people around the country to respect you?
And if you love the city that much, you would think that you would want to live.
Well, you know, it's very difficult for some people to do. They have so, you know, Kathy Lanier, the police chief, she bought a house up off South Dakota Avenue, but she also owned a home out in Maryland and far exurbs of a rural area section, which she also went and stayed time. But she became a citizen of the city because she had to in order to be the police chief here. Well, the head of the elections office ought to have that same concern. I mean, I know it's a lot of problem, but if you want to be the head of the elections office in the District of Columbia, it seems to me you ought to live in the city. Charles Allen, whose committee, the Judiciary Public Safety Committee, oversees this, says he will raise this with the board when he talks to them.
800-433-8850 is the number to call if you have questions or comments for Delegate Vivian Watts or Delegate Kathy Tran. Delegate Vivian Watts represents the 39th District, which includes parts of Fairfax County, Prince William County, and Alexandria City in Virginia. First elected in 1982, she's the body's longest-serving female delegate. She joins us from studios in Richmond. Delegate Watts, thank you for joining us.
So great to be with you, Kojo.
Also joining us from that studio in Richmond is Delegate Kathy Tran. She represents the 42nd District, which includes Fairfax County. She's one of Virginia's first Asian-American state lawmakers and the first Vietnamese-American ever to serve in Richmond. Delegate Tran, thank you for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Delegate Watts, back in November, there was a sense of euphoria for Democrats and for women in Virginia on the first day of the session. You gave a speech to celebrate the record number of women elected in the House of Delegates. Here's a little bit of it.
Well, it may have taken the House a little longer, but yesterday we didn't crack the ceiling. We shattered it.
Delegate Watts, you've seen a lot in the General Assembly in the nearly three decades you've been a lawmaker. What was that moment like for you?
But quite frankly, Kodjo, I have been just so gratified in the weeks since to have so many people stop me in the elevator, on the sidewalk, and comment on it, that it really did speak across the generations of what a long, steady march, and that the fact that finally, because we never had more than 19 women, and now we have 28 women in the House of Delegates, that finally we have that resonance of our experience that is going to be part of the process.
Delegate Tran, on the day you were sworn in, you had your daughter, Elise, with you, and you have been hard at work to make the legislature a more accommodating environment for working parents. How would you describe that first day in the session?
Oh, it was just an amazing experience to step on the floor and to realize all of our hard work that we had put into the campaign to fight for our values was coming to fruition in that moment. I had my daughter that day, and she was sleeping on my shoulder, and I just felt like we were going to be able to take this on and represent our community as best as we could, and to look around the floor and to see how much more our state government was reflecting our communities. And as Delegate Watts said, the ability for us to bring our different perspectives and experiences in life and our professional backgrounds to bear on policymaking was just absolutely thrilling, and it was such an emotional moment for me.
Well, before Tom Sherwood reminds me that this is the politics hour, let's talk politics. That euphoria has been replaced by the challenge of actually legislating still in the minority. Another school shooting, this one in Parkland, Florida, sparked a renewed call for gun control legislation by Virginia Democrats. And a Wasson Center poll from last week found that 84% of Virginia voters support background checks for private gun sales. But recent gun legislation put forward by Democrats in the General Assembly has been tabled by Republicans. One, do you think this latest shooting will cause a shift around this issue in Richmond? First, you, Delegate Watts. I mean, has the atmosphere and mood changed?
Well, I'd like Delegate Tran to speak with the optimism of someone who's new to the system. My frustration is that as we changed from only 34 members to 49-51, virtually a dead tie, I have seen the processes this year tighten ever more. Because on the Republican side, there's no votes to spare. So I find as we go into committee to discuss these bills that the votes seem to be ever more prescripted, and that you may discuss it, but the outcome is not really reflective of an honest discussion of what the vote in November meant when we went to 49-51 instead of being outnumbered 2-1. So I have not seen the shift. I wish that we were, in fact, talking about a true joint leadership.
Ms. Tran, before you speak about that, you know, that is the reality of politics, that the chair of the committee controls the votes and all the good ideas, the enthusiasm. I want to ask Ms. Tran about that, being a new member. The euphoria of winning and changing the dynamic, and then you find out, well, you've lost a lot of seniority by people leaving Northern Virginia. The new people don't have the seniority, and you see all your ideas killed by 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 members of the legislature, never coming to a vote. How disappointing is it to you that here at the crossover period of time, halfway through the legislature, that a lot of that enthusiasm is still there, but the results aren't?
I mean, I think you're talking about the reality of governing, right? And
yes.
And the reality is, I think, you know, as freshmen, we didn't have this session the time to build the relationships to, with lawmakers, to have them understand our ideas and what our goals were, and to walk them through that those ideas. But I think so many of us tried to build strong and broad coalitions to bring for some of our policies, to show that we have good support from both the left and the right. And so I'll share an example that I had. I had a bill that would have prohibited entities that collect data on people's religion from sharing that information with the federal government if the federal government was going to use it to create a registry of people. And So I had, you know, the Virginia, you know, I had, you know, several different groups supporting me. I had the Adams Center. I had the Jewish Federation. I also had the Catholic, I also had the Family Foundation that supported that bill. And so trying to bring together diverse coalitions to show and lift up all the different voices. And so I think there was time that I had to build that with the outside stakeholders. But I'm looking forward to this coming session to reaching, having the time to reach out to my fellow lawmakers on the other side of the aisle to talk through some of my ideas that didn't get passed this year, to hear more from them about what their concerns were. You know, I got the feedback during some of my hearings and being able to tweak and tighten that language.
You just made, I think, an important point indirectly. Yes, you went to the legislature this year. You got cold water splashed in your faces about how it really works. Coming into next year, you'll spend the summer and the fall and go into the session. This is an ongoing thing. I know Ms. Watts knows this because he and I both ended up in Richmond at first time back in the early 80s I worked for the Washington Post. But you have to work on something year after year. Sometimes there are studies, but you have to build things. You just don't win them overnight, no matter how strong you are politically at home.
Well, and, you know, and people say you can't fall in love with your bills because sometimes they get killed. But I think we fall in love with these ideas because these are the principles that are so meaningful to us and why we ran and what our constituents at home want, right, to protect religious liberty and things like that. And I think it's really important to take a step back and reflect on how we could continue to build that coalition so that we can pass the bill.
If you have questions or comments for Delegate Vivian Watts or Delegate Kathy Tran, give us a call, 800-433-8850, or send us an email to kojo@wamu.org or send us a tweet at Kojo Show.
Ms. Watts, I want to ask you about Metro. We just had Loudoun County, the COG chairman here. For the first time ever, there is some move in the Virginia legislature to maybe actually provide money for Metro, which Northern Virginia needs. Northern Virginia is a cash cow for the state funding, but it desperately needs money for Metro. You're the former Secretary of Transportation under, I think, Jerry Palouse. Is that right?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And you know, you've been in the legislature since then, since 1996.
I came back in 96.
Back in 1996, glutton for punishment. Yeah. What can you tell the people of Northern Virginia and the Washington region in particular about the future of Metro as you see it there in Richmond?
Well, first of all, let me say that actually there has been state money nowhere near what Maryland contributes. But Virginia has been contributing to Metro for literally decades. So this was what the frustration was from all of us representing Northern Virginia when the executive budget came out and it was taking money only from Northern Virginia. And we have been fighting very strongly to reestablish the precedent that always there has been some degree of contribution because it is incredibly important to Virginia's economy that we have a metro system. Let me give you this perspective. We have 11 of the 22 Fortune 500 corporate headquarters in Virginia, 11 of them are located in Fairfax and I believe two in Arlington. These are served by Metro. All of our growth of the Class A office space is around the Metro lines. This drives the economy of Virginia. It's every bit as important as the investments that we've made in the ports down in Hampton Roads. So that this precedent has a long history. We absolutely, as we move forward, putting the pieces together, all of us representing Northern Virginia are determined that be front and center. Having said that, I also worked for a long time to keep the concept of Northern Virginia's regional funding money raised here and kept here and determined by us how it would be spent. I worked for years to keep that alive. We finally passed it in 2013. So that my look at as we approach Metro funding is we can make the regional funding conditional on state funding and state funding conditional on regional funding stepping up to the plate, but we've got to avoid dictating it so that the integrity of the structure of the determination of the region on the right balance between transit and road network is something that integrity is kept. Our long-term bonding authority is very dependent upon it as well. The lawyers are at the table, a lot of seasoned legislators at their table, and in the parlance, as you know, Tom, having been down here of 8 weeks, we got plenty of time to go with 3 weeks to go.
If I can summarize what you said, you don't want them to raid the highway monies in order to pay for the metro monies.
I want the decision to be a regional decision.
Right. Good enough.
The regional decision of our authority has always been a balance of transit and roads, and that's where it needs to stay.
Delegate Watts, Maryland lawmakers have been wrestling with addressing sexual harassment within their ranks. The House of Delegates passed its first sexual harassment training policy earlier this month, but it drew a significant deal of fire from Democrats. You were in the middle of all of that. What happened, and where do things stand now?
Okay. The significant difference, and you've said it accurately, Kojo, it's just a training module, just an online, every 2 years you get online, you take a training module. That's not a harassment policy. The harassment policy needs to deal with issues such as, and also there was the implication in what passed, that it only covered what happened in the buildings of the General Assembly in the months that we're here, not the year-round issue when we're in our official capacity, so that when I have contact with any member of the public, any volunteer who's coming down to the General Assembly, I have the responsibility to conduct myself appropriately. And so those are some of the issues that are at stake, but also the fact I was extremely puzzled. We have gone through three significant policy developments in the last couple of years, one of them having to do with campaign finance, the other on the heels of Governor McDonald's situation to make sure that we have a conflict of interest carefully spelled out, hours and hours of hearings on that. And then even this session, we had a public process to determine the use of any campaign funds for personal benefit and how that needed to be spelled out, what the procedures are, what the way of reporting is. And yet this policy, and only this policy, is being determined in a closed door behind the scenes out of the clerk's office. It's simply not appropriate.
Kathy Tran, you propose legislation for all workplaces in Virginia, not just the General Assembly. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I had a bill that would have required state contractors to inform their employees about their sexual harassment policy and to train them. It was simply that. And we worked to make sure that the state could develop an online module for those employers that didn't have training already available or weren't in a position, to develop that because they don't have robust HR offices. And if you were an employer who's a contractor and you're already doing really great things about making sure that your employees are aware of and get educated about sexual harassment policies, you're awesome and you're in a good position. This bill died on a party line vote, and it was really disappointing because I think we see the Me Too movement is bringing out, a tremendous amount of women's voices who say sexual harassment, it's not a new thing, but it's certainly extremely pervasive in both our professional lives, in our public lives, and in our private lives. And women are finding the courage to step up and speak out, and we really need to make sure that we are doing all we can to protect women in the workplace. And I just want to add one thing, that one out of four women are sexually harassed at work, and that's an underreported number, out of every four.
Glad you mentioned that, because one of the aspects of that legislation is eliminating the statute of limitations on certain misdemeanor sexual offenses, among which is carnal knowledge of offender by employee of bail bond company. How widespread is that, or was that brought up by some specific incident?
I serve on the Courts of Justice Committee, and it was brought up by a specific incident. As reported to us, it was backed up with reference to other incidents. And what was particularly disturbing is that there was not an internal discipline even within the licensure of bail bondsmen. Again, it's extreme situation of authority over an individual that if you do not do as I am demanding, I will revoke your bond. You'll be back in jail. You won't be able to take care of your family. The particular incident was a single mother.
Okay. Thank you. Let me allow David in Silver Spring, Maryland, who's been waiting a while. David, we don't have a great deal of time left, but go ahead, please.
Well, my question is for the legislator who had the idea of prohibiting the state from sharing religious affiliation information with the federal government. And my question is this. I wonder why the idea isn't just to stop collecting that information altogether. I have a hard time imagining a state-run benefit or program where collection of that information, at least on an individual basis.
Kathy Tran?
Yeah. So in Virginia, it's very limited which agencies are able to collect religious belief information. And so, for example, institutions of higher education are able to do so. And I think you can see why, you know, a university or college might need that information if they were looking at the diversity of their students, if they were looking at different scholarship or programs that might be available to their students. And the bill would have just prohibited the sharing with federal government if the federal government was going to create a registry.
Tom.
Some people worry that the Me Too movement may not last. It may change, may continue, but the emphasis that we've had for the last year. Do you have any sense of concern that maybe as we reach out more and more across not just famous people, not just high-profile people, but just into the workplace where, Ms. Tran, you said one out of four women, and then, of course, men are harassed too, that maybe that we've had this uproar, but that it might just peter out over a period of time now, and it will just move into the background. Do you see this growing, or are you worried about that too?
Tom, if I can speak from my decades of my life, I see it significantly different from anything that I've seen in the past. There were a couple of phases of Year of the Woman, and it didn't last very long. But this I see much more pervasive. I know time doesn't allow to get into detail, but very quickly, seeing the faces of seniors in high school when I addressed the issue of it's not just sexual harassment, it's not the predatory, invasive action, but it's also the impossible dilemma that a woman is put in professionally as to how she handles it and what this really means in the thickness of the glass ceiling. And that resonates with particularly in our area, with such a high percentage of women in the workplace, that we are talking about the whole being of the person who is female. And I don't see that going away. It is significantly different.
But it remains to be a fight. It's not something that's just going to happen. People aren't going to be enlightened. This isn't a fight that will continue. This is not something that's just going to happen.
I don't see that, no. I see it as continuing because, again, it speaks to our whole being of our worth as a person.
I also think, as more women are running for office, we have record numbers of women running for state and congressional positions across this country. These women are, they're going to carry this energy of the Me Too movement, of the Women's March into office. And they're going to put forward policies like I did, like my fellow freshmen have, like my fellow, like Delegate Watts and the incumbent Democratic women have been doing for years. We're going to be putting these shared experiences and trying to make sure that we have public policies that address them and make, in this instance, workplaces safe for all, but in so many other aspects of our lives, being able to address the issues that have been relegated to the side because we haven't been at the table.
I think we're going to see a historic change, and let's just see how quickly we can get there.
But these are very emotional issues, Delegate Watts. The General Assembly in Richmond had been known for the Virginia way of civility among members, even when they disagree. Has that changed over the time you've been in the House of Delegates, and has the influx of newer members brought a different culture or bringing a different culture?
Each person approaches it differently. So for me, I wouldn't say that it has changed. I continue, as I did from the first day that I was elected, to be determined that I'm going to see other people as with their own life experiences, the areas that they represent. I'm going to keep a sense of humor. I'm going to, again, enjoy the people around me. And so, therefore, where the majority leader and I may have had a real confrontation over the harassment policy of the General Assembly, we will continue to negotiate with each other out of the both respect as people, but also intellectual respect that we've gained for each other because we serve on courts together.
Kathy Tran is a freshman who, until now, has observed the General Assembly from the outside, and now a few weeks into your first session. What do you think of the Virginia way? Do you see it still in existence? Do you think it helps pave the way for cooperation, or does it get in the way of speaking up, especially on controversial issues like the hashtag MeToo movement?
You know, I think that our freshman cohort has come in and we're really energized. You know, we won, we ran on very progressive principles and won, and I think we're ready to stand up for those principles. And I think you'll see that, for example, in the Dominion rate freeze bill. And so I think that there are opportunities for us to be cordial and to work together across the aisle when there are opportunities for agreement. And you'll see all of us stand up for our principles when we need to. And so I don't know if that's considered part of the Virginia way or not and how that works. But I think that it's not mutually exclusive for us to work together when we can and stand up for what we believe in. And I know the other side's going to do the same.
Well, we're almost out of time. There are lots of caucuses there in the legislature. There's a new one called the Millennial Caucus. And I just want to know if Ms. Watts, if you're going to be active in that Millennial Caucus. You could teach them a lot.
We continue to have dialogue and making sure that everyone takes their place in society. It's been my pleasure to help folks get through K-12 with adequate funding, to make sure that we try to fight to keep tuition low with good public funding as well. And so I look forward to the full participation of all the millennials as
you got them through K-12, and now they're joining you in the General Assembly delegates.
It's officially the Virginia Future Caucus, but it's been called the Millennial Caucus, and good luck. Everyone should be a member of it.
Delegate Watts, thank you for joining us. Delegate Tran, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you both for joining us. But that's it for the show this week. Find us on NPR One or wherever else you get your podcasts. You can catch up on recent shows, including a conversation we had on Monday with an amateur paleontologist who found a treasure trove of dinosaur prints in a NASA parking lot in Greenbelt. See you back here Monday. We've got two great shows lined up for you about what presidential portraits reveal about our past leaders and about how small, confusing street signs can do more harm than good. Until then, thank you all for listening, and have a pleasant weekend. Any special plans, Sherwood?
No, just living in the city.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.